Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss the economics of slavery and what actually causes economic development. What prompted this idea was some of the ramblings of the 1619 group, who are, if you're not aware of them, sort of historical organization claiming that America's economic success was all based on slavery. This is a quote taken from a podcast they were engaged with in the New York Times. It quotes, "The institution of slavery turned a poor, fledgling nation into a financial powerhouse, and the cotton plantation was America's first big business." Now, I don't want to focus entirely on the 1619 movement. Other people have made similar arguments in the past, kind of the third worlders, and those in general think, the empires of Europe kind of raped and pillaged and enslaved the rest of the world, and that's why they became economically developed. But for the purpose of this episode, I just want to focus on slavery. Now, the first thing to note here is, ignore anybody who points out that, slavery historically was profitable, because that presupposes that, well, for one thing, it's actually economically beneficial. And also, you know, whether or not slavery was subsidized or anything like that. I mean, take an analogy. Let's suppose you have a company in England which is selling cars, for example. And it's making loads and loads and loads of money, but it's actually selling cars like Ford Model Ts. They kind of like just got hold of them and just change. Or they're making new ones and they're just selling those. There's like over 100-year-old technology, well, about 100-year-old technology, but they're really profitable in England. And it's like, well, okay, was that economically beneficial? Well, I suppose it might be if they didn't have any other cars available to them. But if it transpires that actually, well, the UK government just happened to have banned all car imports, well, then you might think, well, is that really genuinely economically beneficial to drive around very old technology cars? Well, probably not. So when you come to sort of like economics of slavery in a more historical sense, there's a lot of work to be done to figure out, well, okay, is this kind of genuinely a kind of market institution? Is it subsidized? Is it helped by the state or whatever? So when you're really discussing whether slavery is economically beneficial, you kind of have to abstract from these historical scenarios and think, well, okay, are there any good economic arguments to think that slavery actually is economically beneficial overall? And I can come up with two of them. The first argument would be that for any particular country, slavery can actually increase the labor force. And so the more people you have, the more things you can produce, and the better off you will be. I mean, I suppose you could say as well, you might allow more division of labor as a result of that as well. So let's suppose I'm in England and I just get on a boat and I go to France and I go, ooh, lots of peasants in France. Let's just round them up and put them in the ship and send them back to England. And then we can now use them. That means the population of England is higher, which means we now produce more stuff. We can get them to work the English hop farms for beer, for example. So that might be one economic argument you could make. Note, though, that this wouldn't make sense on a global sense, because you'd never be able to increase the world population by slavery. You'd have to do it by organic means. And the other, only other argument I could come up with as to why slavery would be good would be the natural slave argument, which we discussed in the previous episode on whether Aristotle was right about slavery. If it was the case that you could get a benevolent slaveholder and the workers were in fact natural slaves, that is, they would be, they're bad with money, they can't organize their lives, and actually if they were given discipline and were told what to do, they would actually perform better and provide more value in their production than they would if they were a wage labor, then yeah, okay, that might give me a good reason to think that slavery in certain circumstances, but only with a natural slave, would be economically beneficial. But that's pretty much all I've got on that. Tim, any thoughts on any of the arguments I presented to why slavery may be economically beneficial?
First of all, your point about profits are clearly the case. Is slavery profitable? The question is, to whom? To the slave owner? Of course it is. It's profitable to the slave owner. In the same way that it might be profitable for public school unions to more or less enslave everyone in the local community through property taxes, whether or not they actually provide the students with a good education or not, and whether or not they're shut down and they're still collecting property taxes. So in that way, slavery is always profitable for the slave owner, so long as the slaves keep producing. But is it profitable overall? Well, the problem with overall is you need a more universal definition. Your point about it not working for the whole world is true. This is like, you know, this is where you're just, you know, robbing from your neighbor to take it. You don't produce the wealth of the whole. You just produce the wealth. You just take something from your neighbor, and now you have it, and they don't have it. So, yeah, it's clear if you just round up the presence of France, overall it doesn't accumulate it. And, I mean, this is sort of the, one of the Roman motives for expansion. I mean, you know, one of the things, Cato the Elder, owned fields of slaves. Many of them were captured Carthaginians, and was Cato the Younger. The question of, is it, air quotes, profitable? It's profitable for, the question is whom. I do also want to make a quick definition check here before I go too much further into it. The question of slavery, and this sort of relates to one reason why I don't think it is, air quotes, profitable, is, you know, what exactly is it? You know, Walter Block, one of the criteriums of Walter Block is it's running away. It's not picking cotton. There's nothing about picking cotton or tasks generally associated with chattel slavery that there's nothing wrong with the tasks in themselves. It's the fact that you can't run away. And probably the biggest problem to me with all pro-slavery arguments is the enforcement costs of doing it, as well as the opportunity costs. If you really want to talk about the whole, not just the on one person point of view, as the whole. And the enforcement costs, you have to keep them in. And this is one of the points that Jeffrey Humble makes about the American South. One of the troubles with the American South is it had, and this is actually one of the, you know, as much as I'm somewhat I'm agnostic in general about the Civil War, but one of the critiques of the Hans Hoppe's, you know, Southern War of Independence, you can easily call it the Northern War of Independence too, based on the fact that they couldn't accept the runaway slaves, and they had to return them. And this is one of the points Jeffrey Hummel makes in Freeing Slaves, Enslaving Men, which I think is a great title, and I think it exactly personifies when he points about it. The Union conscripts were slaves functionally too. But that, back to the question of what is slavery, I do think that's a churchy point, which I'm going to ask you before we continue. And do you agree with the Walter Blockian definition of slavery? I do want to continue with the arguments, but Swithin?
That's a good question. Yeah, what I'm thinking here is, I suppose more specifically chattel slavery, but yeah, I mean, you can't leave, and you didn't originally agree to be a slave. I mean, let's bracket the issue of voluntary slavery, that, yeah, you were taken against your will, and you can't leave if you want to. I think that's pretty much the essence of slavery. Is that a decent definition in your book?
Yes, that's a decent definition, which you might bring up the Aristotelian argument about natural slavery, which is one of the reasons why Aristotle might get banned. But nonetheless, my biggest problem with that argument is, A, that requires benevolent dictators, and as David Friedman says, there's not a huge stock of benevolent dictators out there. And as far as the existence of natural slaves, I'm somewhat, again, I don't have any clear view on this issue. My general idea would be no, maybe children, but children aren't very good producers either. The best argument for it to me, if you're asking me, is the better allocation of resources, which again is what you stated. But the question is, why couldn't other people do it better? Why couldn't the individual actors do it better? than the centralized planner. Because in a way, the pro-slavery argument is an argument for socialism or central command socialism in a kind. The idea that you have some sort of a master and you allocate tasks, and this goes back to the sort of calculation, in a way, back to the sort of calculation debate. But that again is related to opportunity cost. If you're picking cotton, you can't be doing something else. That something else could be better, but that something else could be worse. You could be doing nothing. You could, you know. But those are my opening statements. I don't want to go too much further into it. Swithin, any further comments or on the next item?
You mentioned the in passing this kind of more obvious argument against slavery, which is preventing slaves from leaving, especially if you think of a traditional sort of plantation system. I mean, it's kind of easy to run away. And even on a profitability angle, not if of the individual slave owner as opposed to society as a whole, you have to put a lot of resources to stopping them from leaving. And say with wage labor, it's like you don't need to do that because if someone does leave, you just don't pay them. So that's just kind of straightforward. So there's reduced cost. It's almost as if with slavery, there's more. Well, in a sense, there is. There's more criminal offences, and so you need to spend more on security than you otherwise would, which of course is not a great cost. I mean, what you don't want to have to do in like a town or a city is to spend loads on private security guards and like CCTV cameras or I don't know, gun emplacements, whatever you want to put up there to stop crime, because well, that means you're not producing other things which are preferable to those. So the costs of escape are, I think, really quite important. Then you get on
one question. This is one of the arguments Hoppe makes in his Democracy, the God that Failed, about private slavery and public slavery. And this is related to my point about socialism. Would you say that, like, East Germany, in a way, is a giant slaveholding, air quotes, democratic slaveholding public society? They did have, of course, elites in East Germany. I think the West Germany did prosecute the head of the Stasi at some point. But you did, of course, have elites, and they do fund them out, so to speak. And of course, Hoppe will continue to critique and say that, you know, that democratic states, in a way, do a similar activity. But would you say that those societies are air quotes slavery society? Just as a,
I suppose it's difficult to say. I mean, there's a sliding scale. I mean, I wouldn't say in modern America is a slave society, for example. East Germany, yeah, I suppose you're getting there because you can kind of only work for the state and you can't leave. Well, it was very difficult to emigrate. You could be going that direction, yes. Because, I mean, obviously the Berlin Wall was a cost to keep up to stop them from leaving. And I suppose that is similar in certain respects to, I don't know, a modern razor wire fence to stop your slaves from leaving your plantation. So they are, I would say, similar. In certain respects, yes. Tim, would you say that they're sort of a slave society?
Oh, I think there is a lot of similarities. I mean, this is where there's an old article from FEE where this is, again, I know you want to bracket the topic, but I think voluntary slavery is in a way a kind of natural slavery. And this is about Nozick. Admittedly, Nozick offered no proof that forced labor itself is unjust, but did he need to? The injustice of forced labor is a premise that most of his opponents already accepted, given that context. Showing that taxation on par with forced labor is decisive argument against the justice of taxation. Nozick likewise condemned unrestrained democracy as a form of slavery, since having 10,000 masters instead of just one is merely a change of master. Here too, Nozick offers no proof of the injustice of slavery, but since his critics themselves reject slavery, they can hardly dismiss his critique of democracy as unfounded. And I think that's a spot-on argument from Nozick, who, of course, Harvard professor, not that floats in actually more non... well, whether or not Nozick is included in air quotes internet cult that sometimes that libertarians get tricked. But the point about slavery is, in some ways, we want to have an libertarians in general want to have expansionist definition of slavery. Our opponents really want to only say slavery exists in the American South, and they will always leave out like Ottoman enslavements of white Christians. They'll always leave that out because then they'll give the power plus privilege argument, and they'll also leave out the fact that, and this is another point that Jeffrey Hummel points out. And I think it's Jeffrey Hummel, is it maybe Neil Ferguson? That the African slave trade itself was initially run by Africans. They were the number one users of it. I mean, they would just sell out their neighboring organizations. Same way with the Mayan conquering of the Cortez conquering of South America. I mean, native allies played a huge role. So, yeah, in some ways, we want to have an expansionist universal definition. Our opponents really want to say the only form of slavery is what Andrew Jackson did, when George Washington did. Ottomans, they're fine. You know, Aztecs, they're fine. So yeah, I want to expand the definition. Our opponents really want to only say one variety of is, and it's rather convenient. But let's keep going on the arguments for slavery.
I suppose I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't want to say really expansionist one. I do think in a sense, when you get to a sufficiently different degree of difference, it's kind of more of a qualitative difference. But yeah, what I didn't know recently, interestingly, I'm in a smallish city. Well, I'm in a smallish city in England, and I didn't realize that actually the Barbary pirates came here and enslaved some on the Devon and Cornish coast. So actually the slave trade affected my area, which I was unaware of until recently. So what we're saying is, so I think we've got the cost of preventing escape is a significant issue. And I think there was an issue in the South, is that the North had obligated to send them back. And if they weren't, then it would have been very difficult for the South to have maintained slavery. At least that's my historical understanding. We then got the motivation of slaves. I mean, the motivation of slaves, it need not necessarily just be negative. You could give positive rewards for slaves if they do well, but it's not the same as sort of wage labor that you can negotiate and you can go, if you pay me more, I'll come and work for you, and you're kind of more positively disposed to work for the organization. I think that is true. I mean, that's not as an important argument as preventing escape. But I do think it's to some extent relevant. To a more general point, though, if you increase the number of workers you have in an area, that discourages you from technological innovation, because you don't need to have technological innovation or more capital machinery or whatever, because you've got more people. An interesting example of this in a modern sense might be Japan. Japan has a falling population. But doesn't take much immigration. And so the solution to this problem is just to get more robots. And if you look historically, what has allowed the modern standard of living is basically more machinery powered by fossil fuels, typically. But I don't want to go on the fossil fuel angle here. Is you've got more machines, because this frees you people up to do more things. And so productivity improves. The higher the productivity, the higher the standard of living, because the more machines you've got, the more you can manipulate the external environment to suit human needs, and the more you can do that, the better off they are. And so I think that's one of the biggest problems with slavery, is it prevents this sort of innovation. And also to note, I mean, slave societies existed in all times and places until relatively recently. They're coming back in Libya, thanks to Killary and Obama. Everyone's enslaved everybody else. And I mean, it's only sort of like the Industrial Revolution takes place in Northwestern Europe to begin with. I mean, why didn't it develop in Africa when they've been enslaving each other for ages, or anywhere else in the world for that matter? So to say that slavery is really economically beneficial, you kind of go, hang on, what about all these other societies historically who have slaves? Why haven't they developed? And I think one of the reasons is that it retards innovation which I think is essential to general development. Tim, any comments on,
yeah,
on that?
This is one of the reasons why I initially expanded my definition, is because you started with the 1619 view, which is a sort of weird aristocratic argument that slavery drove the wealth and made the United States a powerhouse, which, I mean, this is a very strange argument to be making, considering the sources and considering everything else that they tend to believe about democracy, or, well, that's further complicated. But nonetheless, I mean, yeah, why didn't industrial development happen elsewhere? You know, why, you know, the lots of places had slave society. The British ran slave societies. I'm not saying this in a, well, the Portuguese and Spanish ran much more severe societies, slaveholding societies, and they're less economically developed than the United States. So if anything, then they leave out South American slavery, which I understand was much more severe than American plantation slavery. So yeah, so your example is spot on. And Russia did not really economically develop, was fairly backward, air quotes, relative to its similar peers like Germany, when it was a more absolute feudal society. Now, I know a lot of people like Richard Pipes, some people say, well, Russian serfdom is different than institutional slavery. Yes, it is. In some ways, it's more humane, but in some ways, it's less economically efficient. In general, yeah, I mean, why didn't these other societies develop? Why only did the United States turn? And to me, the answer is obviously industrialization. That's the obvious answer. Maybe fossil fuels plays a role in there. And the answer lies in, how do we get industrialization? How do we get progress? You know, how do we get more for less? That's what drove economic development and the rise, not slaveholding. And this is a point that Jeffrey Hummel makes, is that the South grew slower relative to the North. Now, you could say, well, that has to do with geography, and that might explain some of it. But like, I think the North was producing more food and more advanced capital resources, which got better returns on capital than plantation holding. Now, that's complicated. That's complicated. But if you add even the thinnest amount of moral things, and this, I was recently watching a debate about the Quakers. They had the Hicksite split. And one of the early splits of the Quakers was, you know, okay, none of us should own slaves. That's all. That's obvious. That's what the Quakers, Pennsylvania, William Penn. But then one of the debates was, should we buy or invest in goods? Since Quakers were generally wealthy because they work really hard. Hashtag Max Weber. So they're generally wealthy. So should we buy goods from slaveholders? And they eventually came to the conclusion, no, we shouldn't buy goods from made by slaves or slaveholders. Now, that's hard to do. It's hard to do, but it is. And once you add a little bit of moral calculus, then the profitability arguments fall apart. So the whole New York Times, forgetting the fact this is a very strange argument for the New York Times to be making, and of course, it obviously leaves out all these others, basically as if slave societies out. Why didn't they economically develop on only the United States? But I don't think they're really interested in answering historical or technical economic questions. But Swithin, you can continue.
So yeah, I would agree that the question is industrialization. I mean, how do you get that, and how do you get development as a whole? And I think that's where we should go now. I think it's pretty clear that slavery does not produce conditions for industrialization and therefore economic development. So then the question arises: well, what does? Well, the first point, which I think is essential, is you have to have a belief in the material world being good in a certain sense. Now, I think this is a somewhat esoteric view to take, but it isn't. I mean, I don't think it's surprising that the animistic religions of Africa didn't go anywhere, economically speaking. Well, because they thought there were spirits in everything, and you would anger the spirits if you cut them down. And so effectively, they had a situation where they couldn't develop because development was bad. Manipulating the external environment such that it would better suit human needs was something that they thought was a bad thing. They wouldn't do it. So this is where the you could argue the Abrahamic religions, Christianity in particular in the West, of course, was preferable to paganism, because whilst they weren't animistic in the same way, they might have been pantheistic. And if the more sacred places that you have, the fewer places you can actually exploit. And I mean exploit in a technical sense, I don't mean like destroy them, but use them, because you'd have to leave the sacred space alone because it was a sacred space, like a spring or something like that. So you really need to have, in a sense, a secularization to some extent of the external world. Otherwise, people simply won't exploit it. That said, what you don't want to do, though, is probably go to full... Now, you could make the claim, well, what we want now is full atheism, because that's the most secularized at all, and that means we can exploit it as best we can. Which I think is possibly true in the sense of the external world, but having a view that the material is kind of all that matters, I think ultimately goes against innate human desires that they want. I mean, if you look even around the world, if you were to do a survey, belief in God, I think is still like over 90% of the world's population. People want there, even if there isn't, to be something more than the material and something beyond that. And I think if you had a society in which they were just sort of atheist materialist, you could well get a backlash to a more sort of ascetic view that we must get away from the decadent material and return to the spiritual, which of course would be the vice on the other side. So I think the sort of the general Christian view that the world in a sense is there may be some sacred places, but aren't that very many. So most of it can be exploited. And you have the view of the belief in resurrection, the afterlife, God, so transcendent ideas kind of feeds both the material kind of spiritual longing of man, and therefore is kind of creates sort of a stable equilibrium, which is therefore then conducive to economic development. As I say, you could go for atheist materialism, and I think to some extent that at least, as I say, secularizes the world to be allowed it to be exploited. But I do think that could end up having an ascetic backlash on this purely materialist focus. Tim, what do you think on sort of like the material and spiritual views here?
Oh, I think it's an extremely important, and I largely agree. I think a historical case is this Russia. Russia, if you see the rise of Eastern Orthodoxy in Russia again, it has this sort of spiritual, almost nature worship aspect. And I'm not saying that necessarily a pejorative, maybe Rod Dreher would be annoyed I said that. But there is a sort of rise in you went from a hyper-historical materialist, dialectical materialist, like modernist, art, to back to like either nature is good or like these sort of, classical architecture and type lines are good. So you go back to the earth movement and those type of things. So yeah, and this is where in some ways like the right environmentalist at the right at times I would argue wants to have its cake and eat it too, in the sense that at times the right will say, well, the West is good because it's economically productive, but then they will turn around and say the West is bad because it's decadent and bourgeois consumerism. Well, I mean that you can't. To me, you can't have both. I don't have both. I'm a libertarian. I have no trouble with consumer consumption. It's one of the reasons why I'm not a right wing environmentalist. And actually, places like Yellowstone and the Appalachian Mountains today are protected. And I do take the Walter Blockian sense that you can homestead natural earth in the sense that you can homestead natural earth. You know, and the Appalachian Mountains, a long trail along the Appalachian Trail. It's very famous. The Europeans, like Spanish, I think they have a trail on Spain as well on the border too. I think like Hadrian's Wall Trail. These are all natural, air quotes, natural areas. But the interesting thing that they're protected in societies that are more or less, air quotes, capitalistic or more capitalistic. And this goes back into the myth of the ecological Indian. I mean, one of the reasons why the French called them Blackfeet was they just would engage in burnings and stuff like this. So it's not clear that hunter-gatherers are good for the environment, which is a point we've made earlier on this show, which we don't necessarily need to reiterate. So yeah, I do think animism won't get you there, which is not a problem if you don't like industrial development to begin with, which is one of the points that hang over this conversation is telos, purpose, which goes back to the monotheistic religions. And I think, again, many of the critics of industrialism at times went it both ways. They want the benefits. They want MRI machines. They want handicap ramps. They want low infant mortality rates. But they also want to live like they are in nature. You know, one of the critiques of postmodernism is actually just supermodernism. You know, it's like, I want to, you know, people don't eat that much. Hunter-gatherers didn't eat that much avocado toast. It's like a funny meme on the internet about that. So yeah, I agree that animism isn't going to get you there, which is fine if you don't want to go anywhere. Then just live like a primitivist in the sense that, you know, you can use the stuff that's already existing, but you're not going to produce any more, and you're not going to be eventually able to maintain any more. And this is a point that Hoppe made about, like, a short history of society and division of labor. You know, most people, if we gave up division of labor, everyone tried to produce something. And this also falls in iPencil. Everyone would fall. No one knows how to make a computer. So, yeah, I agree. Animism is not going to get you there, which is fine, of course, if you don't want to get anywhere. But, Swithin, any comments?
That's interesting with Russia. I wasn't aware of that, but you are right in certain rightist circles that you do get the right-wing environmentalist, which Roger Scruton, I think, effectively wrote a book on with that. Although I would say that the kind of being an environment, you only people in industrial societies are environmentalists because they're the only ones who can afford to be.
Bingo, totally agree. Totally agree.
Because otherwise, it's just a resource. It's something you need to use. You can't just go, oh, it's nice. We better keep it. Because we will die if we don't. I do think that there is that to it. Although, interesting as well, with environmental damage, it was the Soviet Union that caused way more damage than most other places. Places where they try to enforce industrialization, interestingly, the ones that had the worst outcomes.
Also, I'm going to make a quick point. Also, heritage. This is another point. This is somewhat side of point. Heritage, the only heritage sites that protected are yes, the West has destroyed some major artifacts. I totally agree. The United States bombed some ancient cave in Vietnam, ancient palace. I agree. There's plenty. But if you look at, like, Egyptians, you know, where the safest place for many Egyptians, and yes, the early church destroyed a lot of Roman pagan stuff, but you know, the Roman pagans were also, I can see why they do it, because slavery, hashtag, they were actually slaveholders too. So when the pagans critiqued the early church, in a way, this Roman Colosseum was built, that, which goes back to the Walter Block Israel debate. But my point was about heritage. You know, it's really only like the Protestant and some Catholics that actually save historical culture too, as well. Of course, I mean, the Marxists and the other groups will just sell it. Like, all ancient Chinese stuff are on Taiwan. The reason they are on Taiwan is the Mao Zedong just wanted to destroy it as, like, imperialists. So they have a major museum. I think it's the name of a Chiang Kai-shek. It's in Taiwan. I was thinking of visiting it, but never got a chance to when I was there. But, Swithin, keep going.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this, looking at some old Roman – was it old Roman place? I think it was an abbey, actually, from, like, the Middle Ages. And I was reflecting, like, well, why did people just take all the stone from here? And it was like, well, they were poor. It was just a good place of stone. So when the abbey had gone, we just kind of used the stone. And it only really happens when industrialization kicks off properly, say, like the 19th century, when you get all these heritage places kind of wanted to keep things preserved, because in previous societies, you just had to use the resources that were there. So yeah, conditions for growth. You need to have a secularized view of, I think it's definitely true, you need a secularized view of the external world, but I do think you need some spiritual aspect to it as well. Otherwise, you end up, as you pointed out, with Russia going back to sort of
ascetics. I want to make one more comment.
Yeah, this
is an interesting one. Recently, one of the critiques of the coronavirus lockdown is one of the reasons why animals in Africa, like in Serengeti and Tanzania and those places, are preserved, and this is hilarious to me, is Western and Chinese tourists. Chinese are big tourists. Japanese, yep. Chinese, South Koreans are big tourists. One of the reasons why they don't turn them into, like, ranches or whatever is what tourist money. So there was an article running. I could find the link, but it was like saying, if you want to save the animals, allow tourists back into Africa, or else they'll just start shooting them and selling them for rhino husks because they need the money, which quite interesting, but keep going.
Yeah, definitely. And I say, what you don't want to do is you can't go too materialist. That's just the one thing, because I wouldn't be surprised in the West to some extent that you might end up with some more ascetic religious groups appearing, and I suppose you could argue Eastern Orthodoxy to some extent with that. But we've belabored that point, but I think that's very crucial and does explain to a large extent why it develops in one place rather than another. The next one I would say is the family. And in particular, the nuclear rather than the extended family. There's historian Jack Goody who argues one of the conditions for modern capitalism in Europe was the prevalence of the nuclear rather than the extended family. His argument that if you have like Southern Europe or other places around the world, probably in the Middle East as well, if you have these patriarchs, typically like the grandfather, who basically controls all the resources of the family, wealth is concentrated in only a few hands, and people and sons can't use their own resources and use their own innovation to come up with new ideas or novel solutions to solve problems, because it's all done sort of centrally. This relates actually to a critique that you pointed out to some extent about the central planning involved in slavery. It's a quite a technical argument. There's an economist called Mathieu Matyaj, I've completely butchered his name, he's from Eastern Europe, who basically says that the reason why socialism fails isn't because it can't calculate, as Mises argued, that is, with numbers, because his argument is, well, socialism can, you're a market socialist, you just assign prices and you can calculate, that's fine. So calculation isn't really the problem per se. What the problem is the generation of the prices. In his view, Matas's view, the correct understanding of what a price is an exchange of a certain amount of property for another amount of property. And the ratio between those properties, pieces of properties, are what prices are. And so these prices can only be developed under a private property regime, where individuals who own resources can be entrepreneurs. They can devote resources to one line of production, later cars, and someone else can do it to ice cream. And it's this, you have these different decision makers who can allocate the resources, is what the crucial difference is between socialism, where you have a planning board and a single owner of the factors of production, and air quotes capitalism, where you have more dispersed property ownership and in which you can trade pieces of property with other people. And it's this mechanism that gives price its meaning, which are completely lost in the case of socialism. So I think you can extend this to some extent to Goody's thesis, which interestingly Max Weber agrees with. Oh, well, he didn't agree with Goody. Goody was too late, but he had a similar view. On the nuclear family, it allows relatively more dispersed property ownership, which allows a greater entrepreneurial division of labor. Not the division of labor as such, because under socialism you can have the division of labor. The central planning board can say, well, you're a butcher, you're a baker, you're a candlestick maker, that's fine. But there's no entrepreneurial division of labor. There's no, well, I'm going to use the resources of this and you're going to use the resources of that, and you can end up with more or less property than me afterwards. That just doesn't happen. And so I think this applies nicely to the nuclear family. Now, of course, you could make the case we need to make children entrepreneurs. So obviously there's kind of a golden mean here. But I do think it makes sense with Goody, that nuclear families kind of make sense. Also related to that as well is work by, say, Ed Dutton on genius, which is the genius figure has to have a certain level of disagreeableness. They must be certain, to some extent, an individualist and be willing to offend current orthodoxy or the way things work. And I think this goes hand in hand with nuclear families. To some extent, you want more individualism because there's more people willing to put their neck on the line with new ideas, new developments, which will then propel society forward. And I think in the absence of that, the innovation rates will be lower. And I think actually, to some extent, this explains, I mean, Charles Murray does this in Human Achievement. Most of the sort of technological developments and things come from the most individualist societies, which is basically Northwestern Europe, historically. Oh, and America, which is basically European. So, Tim, any thoughts on nuclear families versus extended families and individualism?
Individualism is interesting to me in relationship to the two types of families. The nuclear family, this is where the right at times, one again, I spend a lot of time going up to the left, but this isn't the right pro-family. People will at times, again, want it both ways. Again, the sort of idea of part of the Protestant thesis to me is in general the idea that the nuclear family is better than the Don model. Okay, which is good if you want more production. Okay, but again, if you don't want more production, then it's actually the wrong model, which relates back to Telos, back to primitivism. If you don't want, you know, some sort of modern, air quotes, high-tech society. If you don't want, you know, if you want running water and vaccine, well, leave it, modern medicine and those types of things. Not that the lockdowns are very, it is a very hyper-modern medicine. But if you want any of the types of those things, you sort of, in a way, need the development. So the right sometimes critiques the they say, well, the Protestants are too individualistic. Well, yeah, I mean, that's in a way one of the defining points of the West. And one of the points I want to expand the definition as a libertarian is I actually think we libertarians in general, the Misesian, Rothbard, Nozick style, Randian style, yes, I'm going to include Rand in that, can win the technical arguments, and many of the more pragmatic arguments against both the Chomskyites and the Carsonites, as well as the other groups in general. I will get back to the family in a second. But I do think I want an expansionist definition, because I think we can win the sort of technical arguments against it and say that the only free way is markets or capitalism, depending on your parlance. Now, I would argue that the family itself is a voluntary organization. Is the family a voluntary, or is it? I'm in general of agreement that it's voluntary. It is true that there are, air quotes, involuntary arranged marriages. But this again relates back to scarcity. Which is a point I don't want to belabor too much, but this is one of the defining differences between the right and the left. Libertarians and the non, libertarians, this is where Hoppe wants to teach everyone economics. This is one of the central points of the accessible Hoppe, not the realistic version. Paleocons oftentimes end up making the same mistakes that socialists make about superabundance, about superabundance of high labor goods. Goods like MRI machines, if you had a perfect socialist economy market, would still take lots of labor time. Ventilator, all these things take a high amount of labor to produce and high degree of intelligence, ability, skill, all those things that go together. I do think, how did I get from there to the family? Well, the family is in a way is the central institution if you don't have a state. I don't really have anything more to say on the family, but if you want to expand on my points, I don't want to. Jonathan?
No, that's fine. I think you're right about some of the paleo conservatives and sort of the Catholics more than the Protestants complain about individualism as such. And I suppose I think you could say I'm trying to have my cake and eat it. I think there's sort of a golden mean there. I mean, modern individualism, by which I mean the modern practice of people living in what you consider an individualistic manner, is very different from, say, the individualism, say, of the 19th century. For one thing, even if you had nuclear families and they only lived in a nuclear family and they were the only property owners, there was no don, you wouldn't live particularly far away from your extended family. And so they were much more involved with each other than they would be today, even though that's still sort of the nuclear family as Goody would have argued it. So I do think there's a difference between nuclear family as such and the way family practices take place today. But still, I think individualism is of sorts is required. And,
this is where I'm going to butt in here. This is where right ruminations might be correct about the relationship between individualism and statism, which is fine. But then all the leftists who drop their anarchist tags and just become social Bismarckian social democrats have a high degree of individualism. I mean, you need the police force to keep the people who critique the individualists away. You know, so like drop a lot of your monikers. But yeah, I do agree that the family is central. But there's a lot of terms of having one's cake and eating it too. Like individualism also comes with problems, and one of the problems of expansionism definitions is like, this is the word the feminist will say, and this is actually where the if you knew them were free, it's actually a misquote supposedly. But Gloria Steinem said that the housewives knew they were knew she couldn't free. I forget how the precise wording of the quote that's escaping me. But the point is that housewives don't know they are enslaved. That's why she can't free them, which was then applied to slavery, which sort of Kanye West got in trouble for retweeting that about the Arab itself, which is somewhat true. I mean, plenty of slaves stayed with their masters. But again, the Carsonites and Shubs will say, well, they don't have good choices. But again, this is where this goes back to the 1619 argument, you know, where, well, they didn't, no one else wanted them either. So, that's not an argument against the United States or anything. It's just arguments against the scarcity. I mean, scarcity exists. You can't get around scarcity. One of the ways to get around scarcity is organize into groups, and the best group is probably a family. Now, the question is which family model is better, the nuclear family or the Don model family? It's not always clear, and it depends on what you want. If you want a lot of individualism, take the nuclear family. But again, you just keep going that you end up with feminism, you end up with, you know, what that comedian calls the alphabet people, you end up with hyper-individualists, which I'm a classic plumb line libertarian. I don't, whether or not scripture, whether or not traditional Christianity says it, that to me is not, this is with the Todd Lewis versus Walter Block debate. This is where I'm going to side with Walter Block, that, you know, we had the 30 Years' War and the 100 Years' War. This is libertarianism to me comes from classical liberalism and Westphalian. I view the Westphalian nation state system as problematic. If you're going to reduce that to the municipal level, I have less problems with it, and so does Keith Preston. But this is where I would say, but I do think family blocks are the air quotes building of society, but it's, you know, how you get the hyper individualist runaway train of thought, which you do not get with the Don model as much, but the Don models aren't as productive. But those are my general thoughts, and those are my general thoughts. Swithin?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm taking a more restrictive one, but all I'm saying is, for the purpose of this, is you need to have a certain level of disagreeableness and willing to go against prevailing orthodoxy, way of means of production or just general scientific advances. General scientific ideas to actually be able to develop and promote new ideas to new ways of
See, but isn't it in a way the mean? This is the point the Marxists will make, that reorganizing society is in a way an innovation. This is the point libertarians make too when they critique the state. You know, it's a form of reorganizing society. It's a kind of innovation. It's a kind of labor device. The family is a labor savings device in a way. So it's a kind of technology, as Neil Ferguson would call it, an app.
Yeah, I don't see why you couldn't see it in that way. I mean, that makes sense. Related to the family, I mean, loads of studies shown that if you brought up by your parents who are married, on average, you are psychologically in much better shape and do better on other sort of general metrics that people consider good, like average lifetime income, etc. So that's clearly important. So a society in which families in a poor state of affairs probably isn't going to give us particularly psychologically well-adjusted people. I mean, I suppose you can make the case, this is an aside, but a lot of the snowflakey SJWs, I'm pretty darn sure, will have had not the greatest upbringings, is my guess. I might be wrong. They may have just been brought up by uber leftists. But the general psychology that they portray does seem to be like that, that they need a safe space because in their life, anything that was had conflict was just like terrible conflict and like violence, as opposed to families who love each other but argue. And so therefore they need to go to their safe space. But that's kind of an aside. Related to nuclear families as well, I think you need broad social cohesion of some extent. As was mentioned before, you know, if you spend all your money on like security devices, that's not really conducive to general societal well-being. Now, I suppose you could say, the military and conflict in spurs on innovation. Although a lot of the military inventions are needed to have a lot of adaptation for civilian purposes. And of course, there's a question of, well, if they hadn't have had the military developments, would they have developed anyway elsewhere? I'm not entirely sure what I think on that. But certainly you want a high trust society with a stable legal environment, because if you don't know what's going to happen in the future, you're not going to invest for the future. So, for example, if I was a restaurant at the moment, I wouldn't open. I would just run as a takeaway. There is absolutely no point in opening, because you never know when the government is going to say, oh, no, coronavirus is going to kill everybody again. Oh, you better close. And then a week later, they'll go, BLM are rioting. You need to feed them. Open up. It's like you have no idea what's going to happen. It's just going to completely destroy any investment that would take place. I mean, this goes to Robert Higgs's argument, I think I mentioned before, as regime uncertainty is one of the reasons why the Great Depression has lasted as long as it did. Because the businessmen thought that FDR would genuinely introduce socialism, like as opposed to welfare state capitalism, a genuine socialism. And they were like, we're not going to invest because there's kind of no point, because all our investments could just be taken away.
I have a real life example of that. I mean, I'm currently planning a trip, and I'm somewhat waiting till after the election till I spend too much money on it, because I seriously think if Biden wins, I know to go after Jeffrey Tucker, Trump has been pro-lockdown in some sense, but he's not been as pro-lockdown as the Bidenites and some of the progressives. They want a British or Australia-style lockdown in the United States. So, yeah, I do agree. Regime uncertainty is a huge problem. But one of the interesting things about regime uncertainty is what's the underlying culture that creates a stable regime. And the underlying culture which creates a stable regime, that it's somewhat unclear, because certain elements may create stability in some ways, but stability is not always a good thing. This is where stability is not always a good thing. Innovation in a way requires some hardship, or somebody has minor hardship. You know, we can make this better. You don't want too much stability, but if you have too much hardship, you're not going to get off the ground. But if everything's perfect, you're not going to do anything either. So maintaining stability, stable regimes That in some ways the problem in itself to a certain extent, but you can keep going, Swithin.
Oh no, I agree. I was going to say a society which has sort of broad shared practices, which is shared. I think was the root of the word religion. If you have like a religion of such in this sort of technical sense, that this kind of binds people together in a sense of belongingness. That can kind of keep people together, and that relates to having sort of similar legal moral outlooks. So I think this is the obvious thing with America today, that you've got really a huge number of different societies existing in dispersed geographical areas, and because they're now diverging in their beliefs of what should take place, that, you know, one party doesn't want it to change and others do. When or who wins? Well, probably ones who want to change it, but just a question about how quickly. If you had a situation where you had much more jurisdictions and they were much more homogenous ethnically, because that's related to religion, and sort of culturally, then, you know, what you could effectively have is zones of homogeneity and stability, but between zones is heterogeneity and effectively competition between them, which kind of spur on development, which you could argue is kind of how medieval Europe was with city-states, but it was all united under sort of like the Catholic religion.
This is all well and good, Swithin. I'm going to go out here again. But see, this goes back to the first-person point of view. It's rational for the statist or the central authority or the slaveholder to have a centralized extraction method, which of course culminates in a one world government, which is to be the highest form of I mean that's one of the reasons why I'm an anarchist, is I'm willing to go anarchist, just so at least philosophically, just so when people, because it goes back, you see this even in the weapons debate. You know, Joe Biden said, well, you can't own a nuclear bomb. Well, he didn't precisely say, but that's what the basic, well, I don't see why individuals can't own nuclear weapons. I don't buy this distinction between public and private. I mean, private individuals functionally have the usufruct of nuclear weapons if they really wanted to. Plenty of private individuals, basically. That's what public actors are. They're acting in the private interest, which is one of the distinctions that David Friedman makes. There is really a, air quotes, public good. They're just private goods that public democratic politicians say are public goods. It's rational in the sense that it's rational for people to run, for the slaveholder to run the slave trade insofar as he can keep them from running away. When the costs of doing it go up too high, then it's no longer rational. For the slaveholder to do it, which then goes back. You keep going at what is shared. And that's true. What is shared? This is where I think the declining, you know, decline in some form of, well, G.K. Chesterton might argue it's overspilled in something. You know, the virtues got let loose. You know, the virtues let loose. But yeah, I agree. In some ways, we faced, you know, a hyper do-gooder society. In some way, the virtues and vices are just sort of hyperventilating. We don't have anything shared. Then you get all these people talk about should love, love, love. You know, it gets sort of carried away. But I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent. But back to your arguments about slavery.
Oh, no, I agree. Just with the tax extraction, that goes on to my more sort of straightforward economist, because you kind of think, oh, he's talking about all this esoteric sort of sociological stuff. It's like, where's the economics? And it's like, well, what you've mentioned there, with kind of like the status wanting to extract wealth and resources from people. This goes to your kind of classic argument that what you need is savings and investments. Crusoe on his island, he can't increase his capital stock unless he saves some fish, because otherwise he just catches what he can with his hands and he eats it and then he eats it again the next day. Only if he keeps himself a surplus stock of food can he actually not fish on one day to do something else, like make a net, for example, which then means he can catch even more fish on another day. So the classic argument is, you know, savings investment is required. And related to that is good old Hopper's point on time preference. You know, To actually engage in savings, you've got to go, well, actually, you know, I'm willing to defer gratification. And this is goes to the old marshmallow test with kids. You know, if the children are willing to wait 15 minutes for another marshmallow, those are the ones who generally do better on most life metrics than the ones who just eat the one in front of them, because they're willing to defer gratification. And related to sort of low time preference is IQ. Typically, the more intelligent people are, the lower time preference they have. I mean, you could argue that a lot of the criminals are actually people with very high time preference, because they go, oh, well, I'd rather have it now than save and buy it later, so I'll just take the car now. It's just a high time preference, low IQ result. And then on IQ, I mean, it isn't evenly distributed worldwide. Different countries have different let rates, different ethnic groups have different rates. You know from your own experience, you come across clever people, you come across stupid people. And what causes that? Well, you know, it's choice. They might decide just not to develop their brain by just, you know, getting high all the time, or just watching sports. So it could be choice, it could be their background, or it could just be their genes, their genetic makeup. I have four children. They're clearly all different. Their shared environment is basically the same. Now you could say it's always, we treat them differently to each other. Fine, fair enough. But I mean, as any test you're going to get empirically, like this would be a control group, and they're manifestly different. And the different groups around the world have got different IQs, and I think to some extent that's clearly genetic. So come in cold winter's hypothesis, the reason why you have higher IQ in sort of the northern and the harsher climates is because to survive you need to be far-sighted. You need to have, in agricultural societies, you need to look to the future, develop your agricultural techniques, and so you can harvest and save the food for the winter. And then you can survive and sow the next year. If you're in a very nice environment, sort of equatorial, where there's food around all the time, there's multiple harvests a year, then effectively you don't need to plan for the future. And so those people who otherwise would die in harsher climates don't die. And so you end up with an uneven geographical dispersion of IQ levels. And therefore you get differential development, which is why, broadly speaking, the more northerly, harsher climate peoples do better. Although related to that before, I mean, if you look at the East Asians, the Chinese and the Japanese have higher IQ level than the Caucasians, but their development was later, which I think goes back to the individualism point, because they tend to be a much more conformist society, which isn't conducive to economic development.
I think telos remains the undergirding feature or bug in this discussion, which about slavery. If it's about trading lambs for slaughter, I mean, the Soviet Union was very good at calling up reserve units in the what they call the Great Patriotic War. You could also call it just called jihad against the Wehrmacht. I mean, there's certain features of having slaveholding societies in certain forms, technical, if you want to call it a slaveholding society. I mean, the South was good at producing cotton. That's all well and good, but that, you know, what exactly does one want to produce? You know, what you just said about things in general, to me is very well. I don't care. I'll listen to it. I mean, this is, you know, even Jonathan Haidt would say IQ science is legitimate science. So you know, it's, to me, it's legitimate science. I mean, this is one of the things that annoys me about the Jeffrey Tucker more liberal libertarians. Is that they'll say, well, equal opportunities, unequal outcomes. We're okay with that. But what exactly is equal opportunity? Considering, I mean, I'm not equal. I'm never going to play basketball as well as LeBron James. You know, I'm not that tall. I mean, so this is where all you said is, you know, extremely politically incorrect to all the hacks. But if you really want equality, in some ways you have to resolve. You have to resolve the fact that there are many ways in which we're innately unequal, which again goes back to the family. One of the drivers of inequality is families. Should we mandate everyone to have a mother and a father? I mean, I could see some right-wing theocrats, air quotes, theocrats doing that. Although we got in a lot of that policy might have actually brought a lot of economic development, funnily enough. And actually socialist societies, I mean, actually China is trying to walk back its one-child policy. I think Singapore's had, they said they had holidays or government mandates for people to try to get hook up and get married. So a state that's wanting to reform marriages to increase its sort of private stock. The equal, what exactly is an equal starting point? They don't exist. They don't exist. No two apples in some ways are entirely correct. I mean, you know, if people look at like two brothers or identical twins, they still end up with some amount of differences. They are similar in some ways, but you do get slight differences which can't entirely be explained. It only can be explained by some sort of internal innate theory. You can't just explain everything and say, oh, it's the environment. Well, it's not entirely clear it's that way. So the factors of economic development to me, what made the West richer in general or developed, are many. And part of its desire to create wealth. So this is never where the critiques, a lot of the, I'm never entirely sure if Marxists are critical of wealth or critical of the distribution of wealth. Someone like, I think, Ben Burgess apparently has no trouble with consumerism. I think it's Ben Burgess. But doesn't like the distribution of the consumerist. He'll say, well, you know, certain people can buy Ferraris and Bugattis and only other people can buy Priuses and Corollas. Well, okay, that's fair enough. But then again, no one could produce. There's no labor theory of value society that suggests that we could produce, everyone could own a Bugatti Veyron. I don't think that society exists, nor do I think that would be a tyrannical world based on ours. Even though a lot of it's marketing, a lot of it is just handcrafted. And actually, no one would like it anyway. If everyone owned something, it wouldn't be a scarce good. And part of the thrill of owning certain scarce goods is there, you know, they're a status good, and which goes back to the sort of Randian ideas of marketing and things like that, which are all very interesting. But yeah, the factors which made the wealth the West, you could rank them, you know, IQ, weather, having a cold climate, having technology, desiring economic development, Christianity. Christianity is complicated, though. It remains complicated because, you know, some Catholics will, and some sort of certain dissident Protestants will argue, well, it's too individualistic, of course. And there's certain elements of Christianity, like jubilees. Jubilees are in some form of regime uncertainty as well, for economic capital as well. So, I mean, if you take one of the critiques of theonomy, for example, is they don't have jubilee. Gary North doesn't take the Bible seriously enough. And that's fair enough. But then again, one of the critiques of the Christianity, which someone like Joseph Cotto will make, is it's somewhat anti-family. Now, of course, all the sort of traditional Christians say, no, it's not. You're just misreading it. Am I? Am I not? You must hate your mother, sister, brother. So even there, when, you know, sort of family breakers, it's not always clear. Things go both ways at times. But I do think there's multiple factors. But those are my overviews. Swithin, any comments?
I was just going to chuck in a couple I haven't discussed so far. Briefly, stable currency, you need that to be able to get division of labor. Geography, this is Jared Diamond is big on, that you know, you need to be places where you have rivers, and so you can connect with different peoples, and so that helps division of labor. I think it's true as far as it goes, but it's far from sufficient in my view. He also makes historically that you need domesticatable animals, although the question then is, you know, are some animals inherently undomesticatable, or did other people just actually kill them? I seem to remember someone argued why in the North America that actually the Indians just hunted to death the domesticatable animals and didn't actually domesticate them. So the lack of domesticatable animals doesn't necessarily imply they couldn't have been domesticated. It's just the fact that they didn't do it, or they could have killed them. So I think geography is important. Things with ports and being able to trade is kind of helpful. But for lots of the reasons we've pointed so far, I mean, if you're an animist society or with lots of rivers, which you can meet different people, isn't going to be, isn't going to, you're not going to develop. So that would be my kind of broad overview with that. And really just to say that economically, if anyone says that slavery is economically beneficial, they're clearly wrong. So just now I'd like to thank everyone for listening. If you'd enjoyed this, please share it with your friends and family, and please subscribe on YouTube. The more subscribers we get, the higher we get in the search rankings, and put your comments below if you have any. And if you'd like to contact us, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.